Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Rachel Moran. She's an Irish author, feminist activist, and founding member of SPACE International, Survivors of Prostitution Abuse Calling for Enlightenment. SPACE is engaged in changing policy in numerous nations to criminalize the demand for the commercial sex trade. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
So the first thing I'd like to start with is to read a quote of yours and then just ask you to talk about that. Let me be clear about this. Prostitution has to do with killing. It has to do with killing the human spirit, and beyond that, it has to do with getting off on it. What do you mean by that?
Well, there were many, many times in my own life, in the 7 years I was in prostitution, where I experienced the man who was using me going through a real intensity of arousal matched by my reluctance. So the less I was into it, in plain terms, the more he got off on it. And that's a theme that you see rampant throughout pornography, as we know. It's absolutely rampant in prostitution, which is where men get to live out their porn fantasies. And not only am I drawn when I talk about prostitution from my own personal experience, but from the thousands of conversations I've had both during and after prostitution with other women who've lived it. So when I say that it's necrophilic in nature and that it has to do with killing, what I mean is that men in prostitution very, very often, what they're getting off on is the frozen status, you might say, of a woman's sexual autonomy. What they're getting off on is the fact that they can buy away her autonomy. They're getting off on abuse, pure and simple.
You used the word necrophiliac, and that is a very important word for me in this context because of a couple things. I'm thinking of what Mary Daly said about – well, let me back up. I just did this huge conference, and it was called Earth at Risk, and there were a bunch of environmentalists there and also a whole bunch of feminists there. We were bringing these together, and during some of the time backstage, I was talking to Chris Hedges about – so who are some of the people who have talked about this culture being necrophiliac? And there's Eric Frome, there's Mary Daly talked about patriarchy being a religion of necrophilia. And so I'm wondering if you can – Lewis Mumford, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit – if you can expand on that a little bit. I think that's really crucial to understanding the whole culture. Or was that kind of a throwaway word? Or is that something you want, or a place you want to go?
It wasn't at all a throwaway word. It's something I'm expanding and deepening my own understanding of at this time because I'm actually writing a chapter about it. But what I mean when I use that word is that there are a lot of ways to be dead, you know, and it's very, very simplistic thinking to imagine death as simply being represented by a corpse in the ground. You are, in a sense, socially dead in prostitution, in that your own autonomy is completely out of the picture. You sell your autonomy, okay, and it's purchased. So once you sell anything and it's been purchased, it's obviously no longer your own, and that is the case with sexual autonomy in prostitution. So I use the term necrophilia and to really point out the baseline wrongfulness of what it is that men do in prostitution, what it is that they're buying, what it is that they're getting off on. The quote that you read out earlier on, when I had said that prostitution had to do with killing and getting off on it. By that I mean destroying and getting off on destruction. And all of these different threads come together to explain and express something that is in its essence evil. And the word evil is a word that a lot of people, including feminists, shy away from because they have such a strong sense of the connotation between the term evil and religion. And I don't entertain that the two need to necessarily be used in the same sentence, because evil to me is, you might as well be saying wrong or bad or extremely destructive. That's what evil is to me, and that's what prostitution is too.
I'm running into a problem with this interview already, which is that everything you're saying is so rich that like there's 15 different directions we can go, and I'm having a hard time choosing which one. So I'm sorry if this interview isn't as coherent as it could be, because everything you're saying is so fantastic.
You know what? We can bounce all over the place, Derek. That's perfectly fine by me.
Okay. So I'm wondering if you can, I mean, you've done a really good introductory explication of the necrophilia, but I'm wondering if you can say that again in a different way, because I really want for listeners to get it. That what is this? And you've talked about getting off on the, well, another thing I'm thinking is something that you've also written, which is that you said learning to dissociate is to the prostitute what learning to type is to the secretary. That's why childhood sexual abuse is often referred to in prostitution literature as boot camp for prostitutes. And that's why there's such an extraordinarily high percentage of child sexual abuse survivors in prostitution. So many of us learned to do the job before we got anywhere near it. So there's two directions to go with that. And I'm wondering, second, if you can talk about the whole boot camp incest thing. But first, I'm wondering if you can talk about the dissociation as a form of deadness. And I say this also, just listeners will know that I was sexually abused as a kid, and I understand dissociation very intimately. And so there is a sort of deadness that comes with dissociation as well. I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit, and then go to incest as boot camp for prostitution.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, to break off and to split off from your own feelings is absolutely necessary in prostitution, and you simply couldn't do it if you couldn't master that. And unfortunately for many of the women and girls in prostitution, and indeed boys and trans persons, childhood sexual abuse features very, very strongly in their life experiences. Now, when I published Paid For, a good friend of mine, a New York feminist, read it, and she said to me, "Rachel, why did you say in Paid For that you weren't abused as a child?" She said, "Of course you were. You know, you'd had run-ins with three paedophiles post-puberty, and you were prostituted from 15 years of age. So how could you possibly say that?" And I thought about what she said, and I thought, oh my God, that is, that was shocking to me. I really meant what I said, Derek, when I said that. But I suppose in my own mind, I was processing the idea of childhood sexual abuse as something that was repetitive, consistent, involved penetration. It was something that went on for years. I had this idea about what child sexual abuse was, and it didn't match my experiences. So I felt that I was being honest when I said that. In hindsight now, of course I was sexually abused. It was just much minimal by comparison to a lot of the women and girls that I knew in prostitution. But getting back to what your question was about how is a boot camp. Well, really, my heart breaks for the women and girls I've known who learned to dissociate sexually prior even to puberty, through childhood sexual abuse. And that was not an experience of mine. I hadn't learned to dissociate sexually. That came for me with prostitution. But for the women and girls who had that down pat, who had to learn that as kids, well, then it should be blatantly obvious to anybody that they are actually one step closer to prostitution. They're much more susceptible to it. They know how to use what to me seems like some kind of a psychic muscle. I would say that all of us have the capacity to dissociate, but a lot of us, thankfully, will never have to learn how to use it.
So, prostitution is often seen in films as sort of a happy hooker cliche. Can you debunk that?
Well, I want to back up for a moment, Derek,
sure.
And just ask you to, because there was a two parts to that question and I forget the second one, so I want to cover that again. When we were talking about sexual abuse, did I cover that in my answer, just to be sure?
Well, you did cover the second part, and the first part was just, and you covered the first part too with, the first part was, what's the relationship between dissociation and death and dying, a part of yourself dying or being dead or being deadened?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that when you're in prostitution and you have to shut that part of yourself down over and over and over again, it comes to a point where there is a part of you that's damaged and damaged forever, I have to say. And there are some women who, passionately disagree with me on that. And I believe that they do so from a place of pain. I think it should be blatantly obvious that anybody who's been ritualistically abused, will always bear the scars of that. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they have to be, you know, living under their duvet for the rest of their life and unable to face the world and move on. But it does mean, I believe, that we have to recognize that the damage is so very, very deep, that it's not possible to ever get back to the place that you might have been in had those things never happened. And for me, it's a matter of respecting the enormity of the experience, to acknowledge that it's not possible to make like it never happened.
One of the critiques that I've seen, especially males throughout, and I've seen this a lot in the anarchist world, is that, you know, basically having to get any job, you know, flipping hamburgers at a burger joint or working at Walmart or something, you have to deaden yourself to that, and that prostitution is just a job. And I would agree, of course, that the whole wage economy does cause a form of deadening, and people are selling their hours, which is the only thing they've got. But it also seems that there is a fundamental difference to me between working at McDonald's and being prostituted. And can you talk about that?
Well, capitalism is abusive by its nature.
And we completely agree on that.
Yeah, and I've always been very clear about that. But I will accept that prostitution is the same as flipping burgers in McDonald's when I see queues and queues of women going into McDonald's and inserting their fingers and tongues and whatever else they feel like, vibrators, the whole lot, into the mouths and anuses of men who are standing behind the counter flipping burgers. At that point, I will say it's the same thing. You know, any fool knows it's not the same thing. And it's very, you know, it adds an extra layer of offense to the entire, let me find the right word, the entire obscenity that prostitution is. It adds an extra layer of offense to that, to have people pretend that it's less than what it is.
So I of course completely agree with you. And is it simply the violation of bodily integrity? What is it that is even more offensive than capitalism itself? What even more abusive? I don't know what I'm trying to get at.
I get what you're saying. I do. It's many things combined, Derek. You know, there is the assault on bodily integrity. That's one piece of it. There is the knowing that a person has to go through in their own mind that they do not want to be there, that they do not want to be having this experience, but that they have sold the right to express their own resistance to it. You know, it's, look, I've been sexually assaulted in my personal life. This isn't something, this particular experience I'm about to relate isn't something I've ever spoken about publicly before, but I think it's useful here to try and explain or describe the difference. Going back about 6 or 7 years ago, I was drugged and assaulted at a house party. I'd been many years out of prostitution at that point. The questions that I had to ask myself afterwards were, why did I accept that shot? Why did I take that drink? Because I would never accept a drink from a man I didn't know if I was in a bar, you know, or a restaurant or somewhere out in public. So my question to myself was, why did I take the shot? Why? And the answer was pretty simple. I took the shot because I was in a close friend's relations house, and I was in an environment that felt safe to me. And even though I'd never been in that house before and I hadn't met most of the people who were there, most of whom were men, I felt safe. And I felt that I had good reason to feel safe. So that was my question to myself. In prostitution, you have a different set of questions. And beyond that, you have no right to ask them. There are many, many layers to the pain, the psychic pain, the emotional torment that is prostitution. And one of the biggest of them is that you have no right to lay claim to your own feelings.
I'm really sorry. And when you are so let's talk about I'm thinking of something I saw yesterday. I was going past, or 2 days ago, I was going past a gift shop, and I saw a there were some romantic candles for sale, and the sale line was, "Want me, buy me, love me." And I thought that was a really extraordinary statement of sort of male patriarchal values.
And this, was this in relation to the candles?
Yes, the romantic candles had, you know, with romantic writing around them, it was "Want me, buy me, love me." And that.
And how strange.
And I'm thinking also of what I've read, like on The Invisible Men. Do you know about The Invisible Men?
I do.
Yeah. So often what you see there is that what they want is what they call, what is it, the GFE, the girlfriend experience, where not only are they buying access to the woman's body, but they are attempting to get the woman to act as though she really wants to do this.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very lucky in lots of ways, and I think that my emotional health, or my relative emotional health today, is in part down to the fact that I got out of prostitution in 1998, which was the same year that prostitution went online in Ireland. So from 98 onwards, you had different practices that popped up in prostitution. And one of them was the girlfriend experience. That was unheard of prior to that, during my experience of prostitution. Thank God. It was bad enough without pretending I was their bloody girlfriend. But another was the review system. And that, I know I could not have tolerated without going absolutely off the deep end, which I was already off the deep end with narcotics. But I know that there was no way I could have operated within prostitution if the degrading, harmful, monstrously painful experiences I was having to live every day were up all over the internet as some kind of entertainment, and I was being reviewed like a piece of steak in a restaurant And all the boasting and the really vile, vulgar, misogynistic, explicit, disgusting language that goes along with that. I could not have dealt with that. And I feel a deep, deep compassion for the women who have to deal with that, no matter what their political opinions.
How does, so let's talk for just a minute. Let's talk about something a little bit happy.
That'd be nice.
and that's the, can you talk about, the Nordic or Swedish model? And, there have been people on the radio program before who have talked about that some, so you don't have to go to real basics, but if you can talk about that and its relation to Ireland right now and talk about your work. Actually, before that, can you talk about getting out and then talk about the larger, the Nordic model in Ireland?
Sure. Getting out of prostitution for me was something that, oh God, there were a lot of different components to that. It wasn't any one thing. I've spoken about this before publicly. My child at the time was 4.5 years of age, so he was just about to start school. I knew that there was not a chance that I would be able to continue down the road I was on and be up at 7 a.m. every morning, ironing uniforms and making lunches and everything that goes, along with having a school going child. It was just impossible. And I had gone under the radar of the social services. How, I don't know. But I had never had any involvement from, I think you call it child protective services in your part of the world. But I definitely would have if I'd stayed in prostitution and on drugs, that's for sure. So that was the strongest, most compelling thing for me. There was also the fact that if I kept on taking cocaine, I wasn't going to live too much longer. I'd had several accidental overdoses at that point. And one of them actually happened in a hotel room, you know, while I was prostituting. So there was a really, really sleazy, debased, kind of, vibe enveloping all the areas of my life at that time. I was 22. And I had to face the fact also at 22 that I'd spent a good third of my life in prostitution, which was, very, very difficult emotionally. You know, so there were several things, several reasons. I was somebody who really, really wanted to, find whatever it was within myself that I could make myself happy with. I wanted to be happy in the world, and there was absolutely no way to be happy in the world while I was a raging cocaine addict and I was having my body used by all and sundry, day in, day out. So it, you know, people have said to me, that it took great guts and it took great this, that and the other. You know what, Derek, that is obviously supposed to be flattering, but you know, and it's intended as a compliment. But when I hear that, I think, you know, really no, it really wasn't. It was a matter of, it was fear got me out of prostitution as much as courage or anything like that. And there were a lot of young girls who never made it, and they weren't any less courageous than I was. They maybe just took one extra line or one hot shot or met one violent bastard or, just went one half an inch further down the road in the wrong direction than I had gone. And, it's really incredibly, the most painful part of all of this for me is the girls I knew who didn't make it. And you know, but I don't go around dwelling on those things and thinking about them day in, day out, obviously, but they are there. And, I am still losing women who I knew back in the early 90s, just in the summer of last year. A girl I'd known for over 20 years finally died. I don't know where she got her strength. She spent over 20 years in prostitution and on drugs. I managed about a third of that length of time. I couldn't deal with it. for too much longer, but she did. And this is what makes me really, really angry, Derek, when we hear these utterly stupid remarks like, where's the harm? Which usually come from men, by the way. And when they come from women, they're very often women who are involved in academia or journalism or have some kind of social platform, you know, to speak. In almost all cases that I've seen, they're socially privileged women who, as I say, wouldn't know a hoo or house from a hole in the wall and certainly wouldn't want to. So all of those, you know, those things, and I've kind of strayed away from your question. You were talking about how I got out. Getting out was one thing. It's staying out is something different. And I have found in research that it commonly takes up to 7 times to get out of prostitution repetitively before you finally stay out. And most of the women I've met through my activism have told me that they slid back numerous times. I was very lucky, I suppose, in that I didn't. It was out and that was it. I never went back after that. But there were a couple of years, you know, that was hard. And it was touch and go, by the way, because I had to learn to deal with poverty, too, after that.
So you said 7 times, and before we go to the Nordic model, there's actually a different direction I want to go for a second, which is you said 7 times, which is, I think, not coincidentally, what I've heard about the sort of magic number of how many times women try to leave their abusers before they usually get away. The average is about 7. And mm-hmm. I think before we go to the Nordic model, I had a long silence a while ago, and it was because I was trying to remember the thing I want to ask right now, which is the relationship between prostitution and trafficking. And what is trafficking? What is prostitution? What's the relationship between them? And then also putting the whole thing in the larger context of the fact that there are more women and children every year who are killed through domestic violence or other forms of explicit violence against women and children than are total people killed in all the wars in the world. And so put prostitution and trafficking into the larger context of this necrophiliac war on women and children.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the bizarre and painful thing, Derek, is if I said what you have just said to most of the men I would run into outside of activism, of course, they would look at me like I'd sprouted a second head. They would immediately move to the man-hater accusations, which is, you know, really... I don't know. It's just particularly sickening when it's the case that we're talking about woman hate.
I just want to point out that a lot of the quotes that I've taken are from an essay of yours called, what was it called? It was called something like Why I Still Like Men or something like that.
I Still Love Men.
Yeah, Why I Still Love Men. And it's so the man hating sort of falls apart there. But anyway, leave that aside.
You know, it does, and it does fall apart, and it's kind of amusing. I've had that accusation flung at me many times, but every intimate relationship I've ever had has been with a man. I'm the mother of one child who is now a man. So, you know, I shouldn't even bother trying to defend myself against that nonsense. But look, as I've said before, if I felt that men were irredeemable, I would not be a feminist. I would be an astronaut. There would be simply no point in being here. And I'd go off and live in a, you know, a woman-only commune or something like that. I don't believe that men are irredeemable. But what I do believe is that men who can see the wood from the trees here need to very strongly and very publicly speak in order to educate the ignorant masses. And they're very often willfully ignorant, as you know.
So now to that question of how does prostitution and trafficking, what are the differences and similarities, and what is the And what is the, how are those embedded in this larger war against women?
Well, prostitution is simply the distillation of misogyny. It's misogyny in its purest form. But I want to, will you just hold that question in your mind for a moment, Derek, because I want to skip back to something you said earlier. You were talking about the parallels between prostitution and the violent relationships with, the, you know, intimate partner violence, as it's called. Which I don't like that term, by the way, because it erases the abuser or the gender of the
right.
abuser. But anyway, you know, very often we're told that when we get into shaping legislation and policy around prostitution, we must listen to women in prostitution or sex workers, as, you know, the people who put that point out there always refer to them as. Now, I have never said anywhere, and I never will say anywhere, that we shouldn't be listening to people who are currently prostituted. Of course we should. But we most certainly should never frame legislation with only drawn on that one vice, any more than we would frame legislation around domestic violence only drawn on the voices of women who are currently being battered up and down their house by their male spouses. That is ridiculous. So I just wanted to make that point before we move on.
And part of the reason, I'm presuming, part of the reason for that is because one of the things that is central to any abusive system is to get the victim to be identifying with the abuser.
And, you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities there between prostitution and relationships, violent relationships. And, you know, one of them really is that when you're in the thick of it, you are not best placed to talk about your situation in an overarching sense. You simply are not. The same is true for me as it's true for everybody else that I've ever come across. Had you been interviewing me, Derek, at any point between 91 and 98, you can believe we would have been having a very different interview on our hands here. But you circle back to a woman when that's a part of her past, and she's able to take a broader view. She's able to take, you know, a view that's not embroiled in the experience, in the current moments of her life. That should be pretty obvious. It's amazing that it's a point that we have to argue at all.
Yeah. So what is, how does prostitution fit into the larger question of trafficking?
Oh, you know, the whole prostitution trafficking, debate is something that I've had disagreements with people on both sides of the political divide here. Some people will say they're entirely distinct and separate and apart, which of course they are not. That is ludicrous. And then other people say that they are exactly the same thing, which of course they are not. That is ludicrous. Okay. So what we need to do to understand prostitution and trafficking and the relationship between the two is to, understand that sex trafficking is something that happens because of prostitution. Every woman who is sex trafficked for the sole purpose of being trafficked into prostitution. Okay? And I have heard a couple of feminists now, including Kathleen Barry, who I know you've had on your show, talk about the relationship between both, by making the point that if trafficking is the only problem here, if sex trafficking is perfectly fine and that's the only problem, you know, or rather, you know, that we've got a big issue. Let me back up there a moment. If there's something very wrong with sex trafficking and nothing at all wrong with prostitution, then how do you explain that women are funneled from one into the other and that that is the sole purpose of sex trafficking? That's why it exists. It's an utter nonsense to pretend that they are not inextricably entwined. And on the other side of that coin, I've had people say, well, they're identical, they're exactly the same thing. No, they are not exactly the same thing. You know, to get real simple about this, if you're going to tell me that an apple and an orange are the same thing, we're going to have a problem. We're not going to have any problem if you point out that they are both fruit, you know. They are deeply entwined and embedded and can never be separated, but that does not make them the same thing. And to get back to the point that I was wanting to flag up that other feminists had made, Kathleen in particular, we discussed this only recently, and she was talking to me about a presentation that she had delivered not too long ago, where she pointed out that if we were to look at the transatlantic slave trade in the same way that we look at prostitution and trafficking, people immediately would see the preposterousness of the view that the pro-prostitution lobby are trying to push here. Because what they're saying is that there's something wrong with sex trafficking, but nothing wrong with prostitution. Now, the parallel to that in slavery would be to say that there's something dreadfully wrong with kidnapping and enslaving people, shipping them across the Atlantic. That is dreadful. But let's ignore completely the plantations, what happens in the plantations, and the plight of the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and so on of those who were enslaved. So when you look at it from that perspective and really understand what we're dealing with here, the absurd arguments that were so often presented with just fall apart.
So we have like 12 minutes left, and I want to get to the Nordic model in a minute. But there's another thing that you and I were talking about before we actually started recording, which is the there have been various – tell me a little bit about the opposition to your work and some of the vituperation that has been expressed toward you. Like who is really hating on your work? You don't need to name names, just sort of categories.
You know, it's kind of amusing, to be honest with you, because the people, there's a variety of people who can't stand what I'm doing and can't stand me for it. And, in a general sense, like I said, it's kind of amusing. I don't carry it around with me in my head most of the time. It's not that important, but I do feel, a special place of contempt for the absolute army of 20 something socially privileged, very well educated, young white women who speak about prostitution in terms of sex work and empowerment and all of this utter nonsense, when they have spent years educating themselves, as I've said before publicly, in order to keep themselves out of the social class of women who are most commonly used in prostitution. And you know, Derek, formerly prostituted women like myself have been delivered and expected to digest the most galling lie about our own histories. That is, we have been told that our imprisonment was liberty, that our slavery was freedom. And when we talk about prostitution, we're talking about an area of life where women are ritualistically coerced, abused, forced and silenced. And somehow in some magical realm that is dressed up as reality, we are expected to believe that these deeply disempowering elements add up to empowerment. This is bullshit, and it is dangerous bullshit. So blatant that it is worthy not only of our utmost contempt, but of our relentless resistance. And it comes from one particular category most forcibly, and those are the women, the young, white, privileged, college-educated women I've just described.
You know, I think the best line that I ever wrote in all my books comes early in my first big book, and it was, in order to maintain a way of living, we must tell, in order to maintain a way of living, we must tell lies to ourselves. Oh man, I just said it was a great line, now I can't even remember it. in order to maintain a way of living, we must tell lies to each other and also to and especially to ourselves. It's not necessary that the lies be particularly believable, but merely that they be erected as barriers to truth. And I think about that all the time, about how it's not only important that abuse take place, but that the abuse be mystified and be turned into its opposite, so that there's this great line by R.D. Lang that we're destroying ourselves by violence masquerading as love.
Yeah.
And in this case, it would be by violence masquerading as liberation.
Absolutely. And it is its exact opposite. And that is why it is so incredibly galling, like I just said, to be fed that lie. There is no such thing as the freedom to be unfree. And it really sickens me. You know, we were talking earlier on about the people who have opposed my work. When you're talking about women who have to go back to a brothel tomorrow and the next day and the next day, I have absolutely no feelings of animosity or resentment, or, you know, there's nothing deeply negative in me directed towards those women, because I so get it. And I would expect them to oppose me work. I would oppose me work if I could go back in a time, you know, in a time machine, because my work would not have bloody well suited me then. And so I get where those women are coming from, and there'll never be any bad feeling for them on my part. But women who've never had to live it. And I focus on women here particularly because, I've written, I don't know how much now about my views towards men and their place in all this. So this is not some kind of, a woman bashing exercise that I'm on, but we need to focus our attention on everybody who's involved and commenting on this issue. And, I do have a deep resentment towards the women I've described, you know, because if you are lucky enough to be educated to the point where prostitution is not something you're ever going to have to seriously consider, you have no damn right to advocate prostitution for other women. Because the reality is, on a global scale, the tiny 1% of women who maintain that prostitution is empowering, and it's something that they, you know, that they want to do, that they choose to do. Those are women who, in some cases, are actually educating themselves. They're in college, you know, and they're prostituting their way through college for college fees and stuff. Now, I never met a woman like that, but I do acknowledge that they're out there. You know, you really don't have a right to pretend that prostitution is something that is a viable alternative for other women, okay? If you are looking at this 1%, you're lucky enough never to have been in the situation yourself, but you're looking at this very vocal 1%, and you're holding that up as some kind of standard for the other 99% who just damn well do not want to be there. I think that it goes well beyond phrases like irresponsible, and, you know, it's just downright contemptible to me.
Everything you're saying makes perfect sense. I think we can also dismiss the men right away. It cracks me up that I don't understand how there could be any male in the world who could support either prostitution or pornography without feeling like, to use a term from over there, without feeling like a complete wanker. Because what you're doing is arguing in favor of something that at the very, 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 very least potentially subjugates. You're arguing as a member of the oppressor class in favor of something that at the very least probably subjugates a member of an oppressed class. And I don't see how anybody with any even remote self-awareness could do that. So I think we can sort of dismiss all the male comments immediately with that.
Well, you know, Derek, the problem is that most men don't accept themselves as being members of an oppressor class to begin with. And, you know, since I've done an awful lot of writing and talking and thinking about prostitution, it's led me on more than one journey, really. It's led me on a a journey of self-discovery in relation to myself and my own racial privilege, which growing up as a young white girl in a thoroughly white society, I hadn't got the remotest kind of connection to a sense of racial privilege. But that's something that I've had occasion to think a lot about these last years, and to be able to frame it and understand it by drawing parallels between the experience of being subjugated on account of my biological sex. But I want to just hop back to what we were discussing for one moment and just make the point that, I'll make a couple of points actually. I had a conversation very recently with a young woman who has been currently being prostituted in one of the legalization countries. And she was wanting to talk to the girls in the brothel about the Nordic model and why and how, because she's been investigating this for herself and has found that the women in New Zealand and Norway and Iceland are in a position where they can actually pick up the phone and be listened to, which is not something that's ever going to happen where she is. And I said to her, you know, we got into talking about the other girls and what the situation was with them. And I made a suggestion that she should tell them all to go home and do the same research that she's been doing. And you know what she said to me that really amazed me? She said, none of them would have access to a computer, you know? And I'm thinking, okay, so this is a country that's been held up as an example of the way the world should go, okay? And this young white woman is the only woman in the brothel who has access to a computer. And most of her colleagues are immigrant women, women of color. So it really is amazing the lies that we've been spun and what people are prepared to lap up and believe. Because if you look at it really on a very base level, if we were talking, if this interview was about the merits and demerits of capitalism, we wouldn't even consider having somebody come on here and give us their opinion from the perspective of being a CEO or a shareholder of a Fortune 500 company. You know, I think very often in the prostitution debate, not only are we asking the wrong questions, but we're asking the wrong people.
That's great. We have just a couple minutes left, and there's two questions I want to ask. One of them is, can you tell me in like 1 minute the, about the Nordic model? And then the other question is, if they made you like the queen of all things having to do with trafficking, what would you do? If you could change policy magically, would it simply be the Nordic model, or would there be more than that?
Well, there would be the Nordic model, but I think that when people think about the Nordic model, they don't really look at it as the three-pronged strategy that it is. People have this idea that it's just about criminalizing demand and hoping for the best after that, and it's not. It's much, much more than that. I would like to see it implemented and further developed and fleshed out. For example, when it came into force in Sweden numerous years after that, then it moved to Norway, and the Norwegians actually added on the clause that was put there to prevent sex tourism, because they didn't want to just displace the problem onto other women outside of their territory. So they made any Norwegian man traveling abroad to prostitute women elsewhere just as legally culpable as he would be on his own soil. So that's what I mean when I say I want to see it further fleshed out and developed. I'm completely opposed, by the way, to some of the ways that it has been tweaked. Like in Canada, for example, this nonsense idea of prostituted women being legally culpable if they're outside of a playground or a schoolyard or a church, as if oppression morphed into something else because it's happening outside of a schoolyard or a playground or a church. I think I'm delighted for the most part to see the way the Canadian decision came back. But that to me is a deep flaw, and it's a flaw that could only come about if you're not really understanding the politics of oppression to begin with.
So I guess there's one more thing before we go elsewhere, which is maybe you can help me understand something that I've not been able to understand at all, which is something that a lot of the critics of the Nordic model, which decriminalizes the women and criminalizes the men, one of the things that those 20-something women will throw out is that that is, quote, whorephobic. And can you help me wrap my mind around the idea that something that actually decriminalizes the women and provides services to help them get out if they wish to, how that could possibly be considered as whorephobic? It seems insane to me.
Well, of course, it can't be considered. It can't be considered judgmental of the women at all. It's judgmental of the situation that the women have been placed in. First of all, the term whorephobic is just, as we know, you know, a preposterous excuse for a word that makes absolutely no sense. I've never come across anybody in the women's liberation movement who refers to women in prostitution as whores.
Yep.
It's amazing to me that it's only the pro-lobby who use that slur in relation to women.
Yeah. So I guess the very last question is, if you could have listeners of this interview take away one thing, it's like somebody says, so I heard this great interview today with this woman, Rachel Moran, and the other person says, well, what was it about? What would you want them to convey to them? What is the, like, take home message that you really want to get people to understand and to live in their own lives?
I would say that this interview has been about the politics of oppression. I would say that it's been a very basic step one kind of journey, the step you would take on the road to understanding what the politics of gender oppression is. And, you know, I try to give people a lot of leeway, Derek, because I know damn good and well that had I not lived this issue and spent many years thinking about it and writing about it, I wouldn't have understood it. And I probably wouldn't have given it a second thought or cared about it. It would have had no relation to my life as far as I was concerned, but I would have been wrong. Because as long as I was living in a world where women were for sale, well, then I was being oppressed, whether I knew it or not.
Well, that seems like a really, really powerful thing to end on. So I would love to talk to you again sometime and maybe do an entire interview about the whole necrophilia thing after you've written more about it.
Absolutely, Derek. That'd be great.
Okay. Yeah, well, thank you very much for listening. My guest today has been Rachel Moran. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.